Welcome to the Influential Women podcast, the podcast where we chat in an achingly human way to incredibly inspiring women about their lives, work, and influences who encourage us to reflect on our own lives. This is Nikki Bannerman, and it's a great honour as my influential woman today is Dame Evelyn Glennie. Hello and welcome, Evelyn. Nice to meet you.
Thank you, and you too.
It's great to talk to you. Evelyn Glennie is a Scottish virtuoso and the world's first solo multi-percussionist with a full-time career, and is also a double Grammy Award winner and a BAFTA nominee performer, a speaker and a composer for orchestral concerts, film and media. I mean, what an accolade. Now, something amazing and completely unique about our interview is that you are lip reading through the computer, aren't you?
I am indeed, yes.
That's so inspiring. And if you don't mind me addressing it, you started losing your hearing at the age of 8, but had an incredibly inspiring school music teacher. Is that right?
Yes, I did. When I went to secondary school at the age of 12, I had two very inspiring people in particular, although, you know, a lot of my teachers were incredibly supportive. But my peripatetic percussion teacher, Ron Forbes, and also the general music classroom teacher, Hamish Park, were just two incredible people. And, you know, the ethos of the school was that every child has a story to tell. And that meant that, you know, all of the departments of the school were very, very strong indeed. So the music, the drama, the arts, the sporting department, science, and you name it, they really were strong because they believed that all pupils belonged in all departments. So it was about creating opportunities and planting seeds and so on. So I was very, very lucky in that respect.
It doesn't inhibit your ability to perform music at an international level in any way, does it? I mean, is it 30 CDs you're up to now and touring the world for a number of years?
Well, yes. I mean, I think that the vision and the passion of wanting to do and to follow through a solo career as a percussion player was certainly something that was just so burning inside of myself as a young person. I didn't always, you know, think about being a musician. I didn't know really what I wanted to be until about the age of 15. And that once that decision had been made, then, you know, there was just no doubt that it was going to happen. And so really there were a lot of, and still are a lot of firsts in the career, because obviously the career of a full-time solo percussionist did not exist before. No. So making solo recordings and so on, or being represented by a music manager was obviously, that had never happened for a solo percussionist. Giving the first ever percussion concerto in the history of the Proms in London, for example, that was a historical moment. And there are just so many instances like that. And that was important to happen, not just for your own personal satisfaction, but really to make sure that any youngster who followed through or came up could very confidently say, well, you know what, I want to be a solo percussionist too. Yeah. And there would be enough repertoire, you know, for them to sustain a career. Because obviously that was a huge part of where my energy went, because there wasn't enough repertoire and we desperately needed the composers to write music for us. So that's what happened. And so, yeah, I mean, but when we think about it, I mean, someone like Beethoven, he lost his hearing at a much later stage as an adult. And I mean, he was such an extraordinary man, and how he basically developed his senses and worked with various scientists in order to devise things that he could attach to his piano and so on, in order to open the sound up through his body was amazing. So we have more opportunities today through technology and the advancements of you know, that allows the most, you know, amazing situations to happen.
Wow, definitely. And you're definitely world first. And what an honour to meet you. Now, you feel the vibrations of the music through other parts of your body, don't you? And you use your feet and hands to guide you, and often barefoot to really, really, as you mentioned, as a resonating chamber almost. Is that right?
Yeah, I mean, the body, that's what the body is. And we can all do that. It's just if we, you know, want to choose to listen in that kind of way. And it is a form of listening. So, you know, hearing is a medical situation, but listening is something that we can all engage in, and we just have to make that decision. And so, you know, if you took your shoes off, you know, yourself, you would be able to feel the music. You may not necessarily be able to analyze what's going on there, but the point is that you would be able to feel it. And the more that you concentrated on that, then the more it would be meaningful for you. And for me, it's a necessary thing for me to do, and I have to make it meaningful because I am a musician. That is my profession. And also, there is quite a difference being the passive listener and being the one actually creating that sound. And it's usually when I'm playing myself, and I don't mean this in an egotistical way at all, but it's because you're, you know, behind the instrument, you're in connection with that instrument and so on. That's really where I get the emotional pull.
Definitely, definitely. And so does everyone else, you know, with those inner senses. I think it must magnify it to your audience, definitely. Mm-hmm. I've read that you've talked about how if we held a piece of paper up to hear the radio, or we put our hand on a wall, you know, similar to a loud disco or at a rock concert where you can feel your body pulsating, that actually the movement is different. It touches a different part of the paper or your hand with the notes. Is that right?
Yeah. I mean, vibration is a fluid thing, so it's never going to remain static, and it has its own journey. So, you know, if you play the note C or something on a trumpet and then play the note B flat or A or whatever, just a different pitch, then yes, that will resonate through a piece of paper or through a thin wall or through a balloon or you know, through the kitchen table or something in a different way. But it depends where you put yourself in relation to the sound as well. It depends what you're wearing. It depends, you know, on all sorts of things, the acoustic of the room itself. So you're never going to feel the same pitch from the same instrument in exactly the same way. So it won't hit your body in the same way. So that's why, you know, when you are listening to sound, it's something that you pay attention to at that moment, but then you don't take it away with you. So you don't think, right, that's how you're going to feel it forevermore. It will always, always be a living thing.
Amazing, amazing. Now, you're on a mission to help the world to listen, and you've got a new book out called Listen World. Do you want to tell us about that?
Well, basically, this particular book, it's a small book that is mainly targeted to young teenagers. And it's just really a little collection of some of the essays I've written or some of the speeches or presentations I've given. And just a little journey, you know, of my own encounters as a musician and trying to adapt to listening. Because of course I was born hearing, but it's not focusing on deafness or anything like that. It is just sort of asking young people to think, well, what is listening to them, you know, and what is their sound environment? What's the sound environment of their home or of their classroom or of their route going to school or whatever it might be? And to really, you know, think about their sound diet. You know, how much are they listening and what are they listening to? And I think, yeah, we spend a lot of time thinking about how we might decorate our room or our house or whatever it may be, you know, the colours of the wall or the type of wallpaper. But, you know, we don't often think about, you know, what's the sound of my room? What's the sound of my kitchen or my living room? And how would that impact or how could it impact on, you know, your own well-being? So, for example, I have to think about the sound environment of my office and of the people who work in the office. So, you know, I'm not going to be playing percussion instruments whilst they're at the computers 8 hours a day, you know. And we're all extremely respectful as regards to what music might be played, if anybody wants music, how much music, the type of volume of that music, and making sure that there's real variation and real respect for each person so that we know how each person, you know, can give their best to their particular role.
Gosh, incredible, incredible. And teenagers are getting worse, aren't they, with a short attention span and, you know, they literally are worse than goldfish now, aren't they?
Well, it's I don't want to be blaming the teenagers. It's the circumstances that we're all finding ourselves in. And yes, there's just an awful lot for everybody to digest. And because of that, we're just sort of eavesdropping in on things. And it is having an effect on our concentration and our attention span. So for me, as a musician who, you know, often plays pieces of music that might be, you know, 10 minutes, 20 minutes, even 30 minutes in length, and I'm asking young people to come through the doors, I have to think, okay, so how, you know, what's the interaction going to be here? Are they going to still be sitting in the seats at the end of the 30-minute piece, you know, or am I going to be playing to an empty hall? So we've got to really think hard about that. And I think this is where everything in moderation is helpful, and for us to really think ourselves, you know, well, what am I listening to? I think a lot of the things that is being fed through the ears, you know, as people are walking around with their iPods or whatever it may be, is the frequency range. We're listening to a lot more things that are mid and high frequency. And that's one of the reasons why we have the largest percentage ever of hearing loss in young people. It's not the volume of the sound, it's the amount of sound, and it's the type of frequency as well. So, and I always think that sound should be like a food diet. You know, if we just eat one particular type of food, that's actually not healthy for us. Yeah. And we might well become ill. And that's the same with sound. You know, if we're going to feed our body with just certain frequencies or types of frequencies, and a lot of the sounds we experience nowadays are cosmetically enhanced sounds, we've got to think of, well, you know, how much low frequencies have I actually listened to today? You know, have I actually experienced? How you know, what has been the high frequency range and the mid and so on? And, you know, I'm not saying that we just sort of sit there and analyze all of this. It's just more an awareness of what we're feeding our body as regards to sound.
Definitely. Gosh, it's incredible observations. Now, you're an avid collector of instruments, and I thought those were plates that you've got behind you. Uh-huh. Those are loads and loads of drums and instruments, aren't they? I mean, you've got more than 1,000, and you've referred to them as like your children, and they're all your favorites, aren't they? Is drumming, I mean, you must have a lot of drums. How many drums have you got?
Well, I think now the collection is up to over 2,000 instruments. And of course, some of them are small and some are much, much larger. Yes. So I have, for example, the largest timpani or single kettle drum in the world. I have something like a 27-piece gamelan, or just all sorts of things. So yes, they've all been collected, obviously, over the years. Some of them, you know, I've obtained from instrument makers in far-flung places. Some of them have been very kindly given to me. And there's a slight sort of unromantic way of finding instruments now, which is over the internet. Yeah. And but it's very special when you come across something that you weren't expecting. And that's just the beauty of percussion. It's so incredibly universal.
Definitely. And you must be proud. You led 1,000 drummers in the opening of the London 2012 Olympic ceremony. I mean, that must have been magical, was it?
It was an amazing occasion. It was an incredible feat of teamwork I think I've ever come across. I think that, you know, every single person, we were all like notes on a musical page, because we all needed to fit together. We all needed to harmonize together. We all had our roles. And it was just an extraordinary, extraordinary occasion. And that, you know, I say that in the fullest sense, because of course the games themselves were amazing. Oh. And for a country, it was just a real gathering of great positive teamwork. So for me, yes, to be involved in you know, that way was amazing. It was a fantastic sort of example of the power of volunteers. And I know the power of volunteers because I have 4 of them here where I work. And they're just the most extraordinary people that can really bring a dynamic to a team that's really quite special. And we certainly saw that during the Olympics. So amazing. It was just a great moment. Yeah.
Lovely. Well done, you. Now, you're a composer for film and media. You've produced some award-winning musical compositions with distinctive sounds. And in 1993, you met the Queen and got a DBE. Are you proud of what you've achieved?
Well, I think that sometimes when you receive something, it gives you a moment to pause and to just sort of reflect and to think, right, what has happened and where are you at now and where would you like to be in the future? What needs to be worked on? What needs to be improved on? And so on. And so I like to have those moments. I think that it's important to see these moments of recognition. It sort of on a bigger scale. By that I mean, you know, what does it mean for the future of what you're trying to do, and making sure that people, you know, in the next generation come through and do things, take things on board that you had started to do, because you want things to be done better, you want things to be just developed. I mean, that's life, and that's evolution, and that's what I'd like to happen. So we all play our place, you know, in what we do. So that's how I see these things.
Gosh, very modest. Now, you're a performer at concerts all over the world, and you're about to go on tour to Germany, around the UK, to the USA, and then to Chile. I mean, do you find it glamorous doing these engagements, speaking engagements, performing all over the world?
No, it's not glamorous. It can be jolly hard work, actually. I think the process of travel now has changed for us all. And so really there's an awful lot that has to be organized before you even get on the mode of transport that you're going on. So of course I'm seeing the back end of all that goes on. So it's by no means glamorous.
No, especially with all these instruments to carry.
Well, actually, I used to use all of my own instruments up until a little after 9/11. And then obviously things changed for us all in how we travel. Okay. And it became really quite a task to travel, you know, literally all over the world with about a ton of equipment. So now I basically have the promoters provide everything for me, except in the UK. It's a very different way of functioning. And, you know, that's one of the reasons why when you turn up at a place, the first thing I do as soon as I land is go straight to the concert hall or whatever the concert is to check the instruments.
Yes, of course.
Everything's going to be different.
Definitely. Gosh, incredible. Now, does music calm you and stop you getting stressed yourself, personally?
I don't really get stressed, you know, normally. So I've never really needed music to be an aid. I mean, maybe it's helping me without my realizing it, of course. But I don't see music for myself, and just to be very clear about that, for me, I don't really see it as something that I've needed in order to deal with a particular emotion. I think what I find, if I'm sort of, you know, wanting some sort of way to just sort of line myself up or balance myself out again, it's sometimes just simply doing nothing at all. And when I say that, I mean, it could be literally just looking out the window. I mean, just doing nothing. And I do spend a lot of time on my own, and I appreciate that time, and I need that time. I'm by no means a loner, but definitely having your own time and your own space is very, very important, certainly for me. So I think I probably, you know, go down that route more than the musical one, maybe because, you know, music is my profession, and when I'm playing music or focusing on music, it is as a profession.
Yes.
It's not for anything else. I don't have music as a hobby. I don't listen to music as a hobby. I don't involve myself with music as a hobby.
Yes.
It's certainly my profession.
Gosh. Now, you have a lot of meetings with schools to help them help focus young minds as well?
Yeah, I think that, you know, working with young people has always been important for me. I mean, I remember in my early career when I gave recitals, you know, every single time I gave a recital, I'd also give a lecture demonstration for kids. So they would come into the hall and then I'd do that and then I'd do the evening concert. But then the diary got so busy that it was just, you know, virtually impossible to keep that kind of schedule going. So, and then I wanted to reach out to, you know, a larger group of youngsters rather than having groups, you know, come in to me each time. And I was part of a consortium a few years ago to try and lobby the government for more money towards music and the arts in general. And so that took a lot of work, really, to form that and to keep that going and to have the many meetings with the politicians at the time. And so now, obviously, you know, I felt that the little book, Listen World, might help reach some young people and teachers and even families, of course. It's not just for the young folk themselves. I think anybody can read it. And so, you know, I think that musicians are always talking about the importance of the arts, in schools, and making sure that our young people do have the opportunity to involve themselves in any form of the arts that they're interested in. And I mean, what is interesting is that, you know, we know that a lot of schools don't now have orchestras or bands or choirs or whatever, but yet a lot more youngsters are being involved in media and sound design. And so media, music writing and sound design. And that's because, you know, nearly every youngster has a computer. Yes. And so those are the sort of things that they can do at home as well as in school. And you don't always need to play an instrument in order to be involved in that type of music creation. Yes. And it's a wonderful avenue of music to involve yourself in. It really is. So, you know, things swings and roundabouts, really. You know, I think that just because you're losing perhaps one aspect, there's always something else that's rising. There's always this yin and yang situation going on. So, but yeah, to be involved with young people is absolutely crucial for me.
Brilliant, and great for their expression and confidence, isn't it? Mm-hmm. Now, how would you encourage our audience to get more positive and motivated? Would you encourage them to write music or overcome, you know, the life challenges that you've overcome?
Oh, I think that it's not really up to me, you know, to say how someone else should really conduct, you know, their situation. But I do think that by listening to yourself, because it's almost like putting on your own life mask before you help someone else. You've got to be in good working order yourself. And I find that, you know, again, just sort of taking the time to listen, to talk to yourself and to really listen to what you're saying. Because what's happening, I do feel, and I see this a lot when I give masterclasses, is that there's an awful lot of external wanting to get inside of yourself. So we're looking at things and we're wanting things. When we go on the internet, we're looking for things that we can use then ourselves or whatever. And we're not really great at listening to what's inside of ourselves and then getting that out. And certainly for me as a musician, it's all about looking inside and then getting it out through that piece of music to the audience. So what I don't do is sort of, if I know that I have to learn a piece of music, I don't go on YouTube finding as many performances of other people playing it and then thinking, oh, okay, right, so I see how that goes now, I'll try and do that too. I have to listen to myself first of all, and that's really important, and that applies to all aspects of life, and it's amazing how it becomes an attitude then, and it really helps build your confidence. That's by no means to say that we can't communicate with other people or to watch other people and so on and so forth, but not to become reliant on that. Yeah. So, and I think there's a lot of fun sort of finding out, well, what do you think, you know, and what do you feel, or or, you know, even if it's completely a different direction and you've gone completely, you know, down a wacky route or whatever it is, but the point is that you've got into this sort of attitude of thinking, well, yeah, what do I want actually?
Yes.
And sounds selfish.
And that emotion, and I've seen you've said to people before, look at TV with the sound down and then see the emotion, you know, think of the music that would go with that emotion, whether it's anger or loneliness or happiness. Yeah. Or whatever. I thought that's a good way of looking at it, isn't it?
Yeah, absolutely. And there's no sort of right or wrong situation, but, you know, a small thing can make a big difference, really.
So how do you occupy your time when you're not working then?
Well, when I'm not working, I enjoy going to antique fairs. I like metal detecting. I like to just be in the garden and, you know, potter about there. I like to go on my scooter just for little rides. Most of my reading is done when I'm on tour. I just like doing normal things and going for walks and clearing the litter up and that kind of thing.
So do you have a mantra for living your life?
Not particularly, just sort of, you know, listen to yourself and, you know, each day will unfold in its own way. But every, you know, action we take is based on how we're listening to ourselves. So, you know, even if you get up in the morning and you think, well, shall I have breakfast first or shall I take a shower? Shall I take a shower or shall I take a bath? Or, you know, shall I have toast or cereal? Or, you know, so every sort of thing that we say to ourselves is followed by an action, even if it's doing nothing. Well, that's still an action, you know. So yeah, it's really, you know, thinking about and I suppose taking note and paying attention to what we are saying to ourselves and how that impacts our you know, our living moment by moment, really.
Definitely. So it's using your senses and literally going within in a different way, as you say. That's interesting.
Yeah.
So your next plan or goal, you've got a vision for opening an education centre to teach the world to listen. Such a fantastic idea with archives. Where are you thinking of that and when will that be?
Yeah, well, big question. I think that for the past 3 years, I've had 4 volunteers working specifically on the archives. And so the archives consist of every part of my particular journey, from the instrument collection to the music scores to newspaper, magazine cuttings to photographs to clothes, just the whole spectrum. And so we're in the process of deciding the kind of database to use in order to feed all of that information in. And so that will form the a part of the centre, the Listen Centre. And basically, I imagine the centre to really, you know, focus on listening. So it's not a music centre, just to be very clear about that, even although it will have my archives there, but it is a sensor that really addresses listening from many different angles, from the medical side to sports, the arts, to business, socially, religious-wise, and so on. Mm-hmm. And really, listening is what glues us all together. It is that one coherent thread that ties us all together. It really is, and that's what communication is based on. So listening isn't always about sound, a sound being made or music being, you know, played or whatever. Listening is far, far more than that. So it's the presence, basically. It's the presence of and the recognition that you want to be part of that kind of listening bridge, I suppose. So that's really important. And I think that the centre will hopefully address so many aspects that we can share and learn together as we go through all of these different times and different ways of living, you know. So we've seen the how technology has just completely and utterly exploded, and that has changed us, actually. It's changed the way we interact with each other. And so how is this going to be in 50 years' time? How's it going to be in 100 years' time? What is our sound environment going to be in 50 years' time? It will be different to you know, how what we're experiencing today. So yeah, lots of things to do. So there's an awful lot of work. But I'm based in Cambridgeshire, and I suspect that it would be in Cambridgeshire that I would be looking at, but I'm open-minded at the moment.
Well, good luck with that. That sounds exciting. And it all started from being passionate about listening to someone playing the xylophone, didn't it?
Yeah, absolutely. When I was a child in the village hall, and just happened to be a girl who was a little older than me, and I had never experienced percussion before, and she was playing at a talent contest, just a tiny, you know, village thing, and I just thought, wow, she was amazing, absolutely amazing. And you know, funnily enough, her family were family friends with my particular family, and we still keep in touch to this day. And she's just done so amazing. She went to the Royal College of Music, you know, when she was young, and as indeed did her twin brother. And they were incredibly talented, both visually, artistically, and musically. And she's just done so much for percussion for so many people.
Wow. So has she been the greatest influence in your life then?
Well, I think, you know, to see her at that young age was quite jaw-dropping, because she was just so amazing. But then, of course, because she was a little older, that, you know, she went and became a full-time student. So for a long, long time, I then didn't see her at all. So then, and obviously, I hadn't realized that I would be interested in percussion at the time. So I would probably say that it was the two teachers at school that were possibly the biggest influence from the early years. But it's just amazing how you can keep in touch with people and how they still kind of inspire you, funnily enough. You know, you still remember what they had given from so many years ago, and you still think, wow, you know, and that's what they're still doing to this day.
Well, it changes you, doesn't it, forever, and then you're thankful for that.
Oh,
and I'm sure the whole world's thankful for that too.
Yeah, absolutely.
Oh, thank you so much. Well, good luck with the book and the new listening centre. Thank you, Evelyn, for your time and for sharing your life story to help motivate and inspire others to overcome their life challenges and self-style their own careers and lives, and make an incredible difference as an influential woman, just as you have.